Time to take a look at climate and weather with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, and John Martin. John, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, come by the last Monday of every month to talk climate and weather. Pleased to have them back, and certainly if you have a weather question, we hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890, and you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Steve, John, welcome back.
Hey, thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
We had some great weather this weekend, and before I even go any further, I want to say thanks to everybody in Door County. We broadcast last Thursday from the Peninsula Players Theater there.
That's a great place. Great.
Oh, the new theater is just fantastic. It's a fantastic building. And so we had a wonderful time, stayed the whole weekend, and had perfect weather.
Well, we arranged it.
Yeah, you're welcome.
We'll take credit.
Man,
you're welcome.
Yeah.
Same for Opera in the Park on Saturday.
Oh, I'm telling you, it was wonderful. And now we've got some hot stuff coming our way this week here.
Yeah, it's pretty nasty right now. It feels like it. You know, if you're away from shade, and of course we're shady, so we walked over. We were in the shade all the way, but it's really hot and humid out there. It's going to be brutal tomorrow.
Yeah.
Well, I tell you what, Roger in West Bend has a question for you right off the bat. So let's go to Roger. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I was wondering why the planes don't show up on the weather radar.
Okay, so when you have weather radar, why don't planes, you know, you're looking at online or something, you don't see planes?
I think it's because the wavelength of the radar is so small that it gets completely taken out of the picture if there's an aircraft there. And also, that radar is scanning at a pretty low altitude. Usually much of the air traffic is well above the altitude that the radar beams are active. And I think it's really mostly the wavelength thing, though. You're going to bounce it off of small objects. You're going to get it completely absorbed by large ones.
Yeah, but you can see other things. You know, like, for example, the National Guard runs trials around, and so they drop TRAF, you know, practice.
Right.
And actually in the radars, every now and then, you know, it'd be non-raining out, and all of a sudden you'll see these features. And sometimes they're like, we think they're chaff coming out of planes where they're doing their exercises. Other times they're bats. You can see bats coming out of caves, if the radar hits it, or birds.
Sandhill cranes in
Sandhill
Western
cranes.
Nebraska, you see.
Yeah, that's true. So you can see big migrations. And bugs. You could actually, in the more sensitive radars that are generally used for research, you can actually see bugs migrating, which is really, really odd.
So there you have it, Roger.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Here's something I didn't know. Official temperature readings are taken in the shade.
Mm-hmm. By shady characters.
Yeah. There you go. We got a theme today.
Well, is this a true reading of how hot it is outside?
Oh, yeah. That's, in fact, the best way to do it, because you're trying to measure the air temperature, not the response of your instrument to direct radiation, which would be very different. You could put a thermometer out on a really cold winter day, and if it's hit by those rays of sunlight, it'll go way up to 60, 70 degrees, maybe even higher than that. I don't know. I've never done that for the fun of it. But if you do it in the shade, you're getting a really accurate measure of the air temperature, air temperature.
And it's because the sun's rays are not hitting directly on the thermometer?
Yeah, that's right.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
So, yeah, but so if on a day like today, it may be in the, low 80s today?
Yeah, low to mid-80s maybe.
But if you go out and stand in the sun, it's going to feel a lot hotter.
Yeah.
Because you'll be adding that extra energy from the solar absorption.
And you absorb it. Your body absorbs that solar radiation. The air doesn't absorb it very well at all.
Yeah.
Okay. So then in my car, I've got one of these, you know, it tells me if I'm going north or south.
South.
Also shows the temperature, the outside temperature.
Yeah. I've looked for that on my car. And I think it's down below. So it's generally in the shade, but it's also, what I don't know is how well is it shielded from the engine and the roadway heat.
Yeah.
So I think that I use those things generally as a good guide to looking at temperature changes as you move.
Okay.
But on the other hand, you know, we correlate it to listening to temperature reports from wonderful voices on Wisconsin Public Radio. and a lot of times they're similar. So they must do a pretty good job in shielding
it. Within a degree or two anyway.
Yeah.
Usually seems pretty close.
Yeah. You know, the other thing you notice is that if you have one of those, and if you just have it, your car sitting in a parking lot, When you first turn it on, it'll be hotter. But then as you move, I guess the air is flowing through it.
It gets ventilated,
ventilated, and you'll actually watch the temperature go down because now you're getting a more accurate measure of the air temperature and not gains of energy from other places like hot parking lots.
Hot parking lots, sure. Bob in McFarland has a question or comment. Hi, Bob.
Hi, Larry. This is Bob Morrison. Haven't talked to you for a long time.
No.
Nope. The weathermen, I've been waiting for them for a long time.
Uh-oh.
So are you ready, guys?
We are ready, Bob.
We are ready, Bob.
Okay. I watch the Doppler radar on my computer, and when storms are projected, I kind of watch them create and come in. Mm-hmm. And it seems a lot of them come in from the northwest or southeast, and they get to the Madison area, and they split. Go south of us or north of us. Now, is this my imagination, or does this really happen?
I think it does happen. I don't know if that is what always happens. I think, you know, we tend to have, I feel the same way as you do. If you're somebody who likes to see these storms roll in the summertime, it frustrates me to no end when I see something on the way in from the northwest that suddenly seems to evaporate around central Dane County. It drives me crazy. Mm. I haven't, though, kept a record of how many times it actually does do that. So I can't say that it's anything more than anecdotal, even for myself, that it seems to happen frequently. I don't know that that's true.
It really does.
Yeah.
Just this year, with all the rain we had, I would see these beautiful storms coming, and I thought, oh, we need rain. Here it is. And boy, it goes north and south. My wife said, even with a Doppler, you're not correct on your weather. So, this is making life tough here.
Well, there are hills to our west that are pretty sizable, and I think sometimes, given the right kind of flow in the lower part of the atmosphere, those hills might interfere with the sustenance of a thunderstorm across the central part of our own county. So I think there is some physical reason for that. I don't know how frequently it happens, but the recently deceased great late Reed Bryson used to talk to me about that, saying, you know, don't neglect those Baraboo Hills. They're not an insignificant thing when it comes to thunderstorms coming across the state. So they may be a factor, yeah.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
Some people say that it's the lakes that do it.
No.
No, lakes are to our east, so it's not going to be a factor on those ones that come from the northwest.
No, lakes wouldn't do it. Thanks again for calling. Appreciate it. Good talking to you. Thank you. Carol in McNaughton, your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Hi, Steve. It's Carol Rosenberg. How are you?
Hi, Carol. How you doing?
I'm great. Up north this summer, having a good time.
Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
You taking any classes?
It's really been quite good, except we are wondering, it has been so windy every time we get a storm. And by the way, they do seem to split. They go to Wausau or they go to the UP, it seems. And we finally started getting a few coming through last week.
So they seem to be splitting everywhere. Is that what we're saying?
Yeah.
Everywhere somebody lives.
But the wind, what about the wind? Has this been an unusually windy
you know,
at least in this part of Wisconsin, it seems to be that, I mean, what we haven't, I mean, like I looked at the weather forecast this week, I'm like, oh, wow, it's going to actually be above 80 every day this week. I might actually be able to go swimming.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you should raise this because I live on the north end of town, actually in a little bit of Westport, and went to the Wanakee Day Parade and biked there. And it seemed like I was biking into the wind the whole time. And I was thinking, you know, it does seem windier than it has been in the past. And I was commiserating as I was trying to bike into this wind to think, I've got to go look at the data and find out what has been the trends in wind speeds over the year. Because it certainly has been over the last few years, I'd say, seems windier to me than in the past. And I don't know if it's because of where I lived and how I moved around during my time here.
Or that your legs are a little bit tired.
I'm getting older.
Well, I said it more politely than that.
But yeah, Carol, I think that's a really good idea. I think somebody, because we've looked at temperature trends, and I don't know of anybody who's looked at wind trends.
Well, I guess we got ourselves a project for the fall.
That sounds like a good one to do with your class, yeah.
Yeah. All right, well, nice talking to you. Say hi to Ann, and I'll see you soon, I'm sure.
All righty. Bye-bye.
All right, thanks, Carol. Thank you for calling. And Carol is an instructor in the department?
No, she teaches, I think it's middle school or high school now, science.
Cool.
She's a great science teacher. She's been in a couple of our summer workshops on weather and climate. Extremely knowledgeable woman about weather and geology, and particularly of Wisconsin. She's great to have around on a trip, because if you don't know something, Carol
will.
Probably does.
Well, let's go to Phil in Hebron, Illinois. Hi, Phil.
Hi, guys. Good morning to you.
Morning.
I don't know if you remember the last time I called and bemoaned the fact that I was standing in the mud here in Hebron,
yeah,
Illinois.
Yeah, I remember that.
All right. Well, I told you guys, I took 7 inches of rain in June.
Yeah.
I've taken 7.5 in July and 30 since the 15th of March.
Mm.
I have talked to somebody who told me the only way to break a major pattern like this is for a hurricane or something to majorly stir up the atmosphere. Do you buy that, or am I going to keep standing in the mud?
Yeah, I don't buy it, but I don't know. I hope you're not going to keep standing in the mud, but I don't buy that. I think there's so many other options the atmosphere can throw at us to break down what seem to be long-term trends, and hurricanes are one of those options, but certainly not the only one. So I don't buy that. It sounds like that's an argument based on all the eggs in one basket. So,
well, I've gone 6 days without an inch and a half rain, so I'm considering this a dry period.
Yeah, that's right. I guess it is.
But are you still in the mud?
Thank you.
Is it still muddy down there?
Well, actually, the surface is drying out, but the fella next to me just dissed down some, what was drowned at alfalfa, and he pulled up water 3 inches under the surface and buried his tractor.
Wow.
And the surface was, you wouldn't put mud on your boots, but he found it as soon as he put a disc down.
So unbelievable.
Wow. It's been pretty exciting. The tiles haven't stopped flowing since last August 5th.
Yeah, and that's when we got inundated here. And, you know, the month of July for us hasn't been as bad as it has for you. I know we've seen things going south of the border a lot in July.
Yeah.
But June, we got the same one you did.
Yeah.
There you go.
Thanks, Phil, for calling. Keep reporting.
Yeah.
Let us know if you're ever going to get a disc in the ground in Hebron, Illinois. And Jim in Winneconne. Hi, Jim.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I've got a question about wind chill. When they tell me that the wind is blowing and it's, for example, 10 below zero, how do the weather people, the meteorologists, really know what 10 degrees below zero feels like?
Oh, so you mean when they convert it to a wind chill?
Correct.
Yeah. They used to do it by measurements made in terms of, I think it was a bucket of water in Antarctica. That was the old wind chill. And if you remember, about 4, 5, 6 years ago, they changed that and they upgraded it. And what they did was they actually modeled the human body. So they know, based on the thermal conductivity of the skin and the average size of a human, actually modeled how fast would we cool down given a given temperature and a given wind speed. And so they did that calculation. They got a bunch of data and then they fit a line to it. So that's pretty much how we do the wind chill now.
And the pail was, they stuck a pail out of water in Antarctica and waited for it to freeze? Or
pretty much. We'd see how long it freezed under different temperatures and different wind speeds. It wasn't a very representative.
but in both cases, they're trying to measure how fast the combination of temperature and wind extracts heat from a warm body.
Yeah.
Either a bucket of water or your own body, and then trying to calibrate that to a still air temperature. So that's the basic idea, but I think the new method's better.
Yeah, definitely more representative.
You're right.
Thanks, Jim.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Yeah, appreciate the call very much. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, one of our guests, the other, John Martin, both are professors. John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, here on the Ideas Network. Talking climate and weather now with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Really pleased to have you listening in. Certainly, if you have a question about weather or climate, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. And some callers already online, so let's go to the phones here and to Michael in Friendship. Michael, hi.
Yes, hi, Larry. 1936 was one of two terrible drought and high temperature years in Wisconsin in the 1930s, and the record temperature was set at 112 degrees in Wisconsin Dells in 1936.
Wow. I had 114, but...
That's what I thought it was, too, 114.
July 13th, I think it was.
Right, 1936. Actually, there were, if you plot out the number of record temperatures, now this is pre-2000, I haven't done this past 2000, the 1930s was the decade with the most record temperature set. And I mean, that was the Dust Bowl era and everything as well, so clearly there was a climate perturbation going on in the 30s. But I think it's 114 degrees. 114 degrees, yeah.
Oh,
that's hot. Brutal. Hot, right. 114, 112, you know, I mean, I think it's going to feel really, really bad.
July, and then what would the humidity be like?
That's a good question. Yeah, you'd have to have an independent measurement of that. It doesn't always go hand in hand. It probably was miserable.
Yeah,
so
yeah. Given
I'm
where
sure
we
the
are.
The dew points were probably in the 70s. It was July 13th. Crops had failed probably pretty widely in Iowa, so that you didn't have all the water coming out of the corn like you would in most Julys, where dew points would be way high. Yeah. So I don't know what that was, but it doesn't matter. Yeah.
Right.
Whether it's a dry or a moist heat at 114,
right.
It doesn't matter.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay.
Yeah, appreciate the call. Yeah, I played golf in Arizona when, I don't know, it was over 100 degrees.
Mm. Yeah.
It's dry heat.
Yeah. Yeah, so it doesn't, I mean, generally, we don't think it feels
feel
that
as
hot.
Doesn't feel as bad.
Yeah, because the evaporation works in terms of cooling your body.
That's the ticket.
Unless
you really
would
run
take
golfing.
These big, enormous bottles, plastic Coke bottles or whatever, and fill them up and freeze them overnight, and then we just put those in the back of the cart, and they'd start melting immediately, you'd have nice ice water through the whole round.
Oh, right, yeah.
That's the way to do it. Joshua and Ettrick, it's your turn. Hi, Josh.
Hi, how you guys doing today?
Good.
My question is, I live in the middle of a valley, and my wife, she's definitely afraid of tornadoes.
Mm.
And I tell her that, you know, if a tornado ever landed, it wouldn't be able to hit our house because it wouldn't be able to drop, you know, that distance. I wonder if there's any truth to that, or if I'm just telling a white lie. So.
You're telling a white lie, but keep telling it.
I would recommend keep telling it.
Okay.
But I don't think there's any, you don't have immunity just living in a valley. You might have a lower probability, but tornadoes are such low probability events anyway that it's going to be lost in that noise.
Right. And if you ever get unlucky, you could just blame it on us.
That's right.
They told me to tell you this.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Josh. Thank you for calling. Oh, boy. Carol in Caledonia, Minnesota, it is your turn. Hi, Carol.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I have a question. Twice now and in different years, it happened this morning, when I go running in the morning, and I live, as you know, in the Cooley region, and I live up on a ridge.
Yeah.
And there was fog in the valley, and so it was kind of lifting as I was running, and of course there was sun here on the ridge. And I have seen what I call a fog bow, because it's shaped like a rainbow, but it's just a deeper white fog than the other fog around it. And I wondered what that is.
It's a fog bow, and I'm so jealous because I have wanted to see those. And it's exactly what you said. It's a rainbow. But fog droplets are a lot smaller than rain droplets. And in rain droplets, as the light goes through and bounces off the back of the droplets, the light gets separated. The colors get refracted. And so you can see the colors. But in fog droplets, they're too small to completely separate out those colors. So what you see is a bow that's just a white band that looks brighter than the other fog around it.
Okay, so it is called a fog bow.
It is, yes. Please take a picture and send it to us. I had one chance in Alaska, actually, to see it. I was going to a meeting, and a bunch of people left together, and I decided to finish eating my breakfast. They got to the meeting, and they were like, "You see the fog bowl?" And I was like, "What fog bowl?"
Well, you come up here and run with me in the morning.
I guess that's what I have to do.
Thanks, Carol.
Thank you.
Appreciate the call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. Give a call. We'll get you on pretty fast. What causes colored lightning rather than the yellowish white that we usually see?
Yeah, you know, lightning gets so hot that its actual color, if you were up close, would be just white. It would be white hot, actually. So the colors that we see are actually what happens to that light as it leaves the bolt and transfers through the atmosphere and get to our eyes. So if it's far away, a lot of times we'll see purplish, bluish lightning, particularly at night. And that's because blue light is being scattered by that light, just like it does during the day. So the same reason that we have a blue sky gives it that bluish, purplish tint. Other times people have talked about pink lightning in snowstorms.
I've seen that.
Yeah, and a lot of that is with the scattering by the scattering and absorption by the ice crystals in the snowstorms. So a lot of it is with what's happening. It wants that light leaves it and reaches your eye.
Yeah, and sometimes it's kind of even reddish or orangey, and that's usually on a dusty day.
Yeah, right. So aerosols, you know, like if you go to Mars, Mars has got like a red atmosphere because the dust there scatters red light, so lightning could look red in those situations.
I think it was about within the past month or so, we had a storm come through town, and the thunder kind of woke me up. It was midnight, 1 or 1 o'clock in the morning, something like that, and we were able to look out over the lake from our bedroom. And so I'm watching the lightning kind of go across the sky. It didn't seem to be going down.
Yeah, there's different types of lightning. The ones that go from the cloud to the ground, we call cloud-to-ground lightning. The ones that go horizontal, good idea. The ones that go horizontal from one cloud to another, we call cloud-to-cloud lightning. So those ones that are horizontal, that's what's happening. In fact, most of the lightning doesn't hit the ground. Most of the lightning stays up in the cloud.
Yeah, and then there's in-cloud lightning, which sometimes you just see the cloud get bright, but you don't see a bolt, and that's in-cloud
lightning. I saw quite a bit of that the same night.
Yeah. Yep. You know, I think I saw that same storm because we live on the north end of the lake. And
I'm thinking it was a Thursday, July 3rd event.
That could have been.
July 10th was one at about 5 p.m., and the one that I'm thinking of was late at night, was July 3rd, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty impressive.
I didn't get woken up. I was awake all the time. I was working.
I was asleep. I was not working.
I was for a while. I woke me up, and I enjoyed being woken up.
Oh, it was spectacular and fun to watch. Jerry in Viola has a question or comment. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good.
I was wondering why the temperature drops a few degrees just before dawn or just at dawn. I noticed that particularly in the winter up here.
Yeah, you know,
that's a
great question. I remember a couple of years ago, hunters came in and noticed that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what it is that particularly in the fall, is that what you said, in the fall?
Well, I noticed in the winter mostly.
In the winter.
Because, it's dark and dawn is later.
Yeah.
I get up about 4:35, and that's when I can, notice that the most.
Yeah. I think what it has to do with is processes near the ground. So when the sun comes up, if there's any dew or frost on the ground, the sun evaporates that. And that evaporation causes a cooling, which would cool the air down low near the ground.
My temperature reads about 15 feet off the ground. Would that still be that?
No.
It might also be this, and I'm thinking this, because when I was a young boy, I delivered papers in the morning, and I'd leave in the dock, and I'd come home. You know, on a cold day, I always wanted to know what was the coldest day of the winter, so I kept records of these things. And so it'd be like -5 or something in New England, and I'd come back, and it was just the sun was barely peeking above the horizon. It would be -8, and I think, how can it be colder with the sun out? And the reason is because for a few minutes, depending on what the surface conditions are, and this is, I think, I agree with Steve, but for a few minutes, once that sun peaks over the horizon, the ground is still losing more energy than it's gaining from that meager incoming solar radiation. So it's going to continue to cool a little bit, and if you catch it at the right time, you'll notice that. Now, if I'd gotten home late on my route, I wouldn't notice it. I'd come back, it'd be -4, and I'd say, that's in accord with what I'd expect.
Right.
But if you get there at the right time, just 5 or 10 minutes maybe after sunrise on a clear morning, you're likely to see it get colder after the sun rises for that reason.
Yeah, I notice that all the time.
Yeah, it's neat, isn't it?
That makes good sense.
Yeah, it does. You're a smart guy.
Hey, I try.
Bart in Whitewater, let's go to you. Hi, Bart.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm originally from Texas. I'm working up here in the Whitewater area. And I'm from the area in Texas that they consider Tornado Alley. And I've noticed in the last, I would say, 5 years, it seems to me like the Tornado Alley has moved further east, like to Mississippi, Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, up in that area. And I was wondering if your guest had any thoughts on that, or if they had noticed that or seen any data on it.
I can't say I've seen any data on that, but I can say that it's strongly controlled by where weather systems in the upper, maybe half of the atmosphere, migrate across the southwest and central United States. So if they move a little bit further east in 1 year versus another, then you're probably going to find the storms being a little further to the east. But boy, you know, that this is the Ardmore to Wichita Falls area, right? Something like that. Across the Red River, that is one heck of a place to live. That's the bullseye for tornadoes in the world.
Yeah.
So maybe there's a little bit of year-to-year variability, but I bet if you look at a long enough time period, even 10-year period, even in the midst of 5 years where you think they've moved to the east, you're still going to find that's the bullseye, I'd bet.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't heard anything that people are saying, hey, it seems like these things are actually statistically moving to the east. I haven't heard that yet.
Well, I'd seen on the Weather Channel here probably a month ago, they were talking about the amount of tornadoes per state, and Tennessee, I believe, was leading the states, which is not typically.
No, that's right. That's unusual. Yeah. That's unusual.
Have you seen a tornado before?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Not something you want to see coming at you.
Yeah. Right.
No.
In this year in particular is an odd tornado year. We're way ahead nationally of the average.
Well, Wisconsin's had 30 so far this year.
Yeah, which is ridiculous.
And we average about 21.
And the nation's had 12. The nation's had 1,200, I think.
Oh, right.
And that's more than a usually one full year's supply. And we haven't even really had our tornado season up here. It's just beginning, to be honest. So, an amazing year.
Yeah. Thanks, Bart.
You bet.
Appreciate the call. Why does hail accompany a tornado?
Well,
it doesn't always.
Tornadoes are spawned by severe thunderstorms. These are storms with really strong updrafts and downdrafts of air in them, on the order of 100 miles per hour or more. The air can be rising, and that's about 1,000 times its normal speed of ascent. And what happens in certain cases when you have such strong up and downdrafts is you can make your precipitation particles inside the cloud can be caught in an updraft and go way up to get cold and freeze, and then they'll be caught soon in a downdraft and bring them down, accrete a little more water on top of them, and then get shot back up in the updraft, and they keep gaining ice mass by going up and down in the thunderstorm. And they couldn't do that without the really strong up and downdrafts. So that's how they can be correlated with tornadoes.
Fritz and Ephraim, it's your turn now. Hi, Fritz.
Good morning.
Morning.
Well, what a beautiful day out there. It's just sunny and bright. I belong to a group, and to all our board members was mailed a publication, Nature, Not Human Activity, Rules the Climate. And it's by a group called Science and Environmental Policy Project, and they're in Chicago, Illinois.
What is the name of the group that you're in? And I'm asking this because I was talking to a friend this weekend, and she got that same publication, and she's part of a natural environmentalist group.
Yeah, I'm in with the Door County Environmental Council, and we're having Peter Annan up here the 20th of August talking about, the Great Lakes.
Oh, good.
But the group is called the Heartland Institute and also Science and Environmental Policy Project. And I looked at it, and they give graphs and stuff like that, rationalizing their view.
I haven't seen it, but from the description that she gave me, I mean, that's what it is. It's a rationalization of their view. It's not a scientific perspective from what the graphs that she described to me. It's a political document. Apparently it's pretty glitzy, so it looks pretty fancy, which means it's pretty expensive. Yeah. But I'd use it to start fires.
I get it. But the other question I had was I was out on the bay on Saturday, and they were the Green Bay Weather Service was predicting gusts up to 30 knots out of the northwest, and I'm out there, and it's almost flat calm. Mm. And how can there be such a discrepancy?
Well, it could be a whole bunch of reasons. I sound like a mechanic. I just brought my car in last week, and I said, can you tell by talking on the phone what it was? He says, no, there's a million things that could be wrong with your car. So I don't mean to sound like a mechanic. Nothing wrong with mechanics. They did a good job for me. But there's so many things that could account for that. If they know those winds are going to be strong over the lake, that would be one set of conditions, and they might give a small craft advisory. I don't know if they did that. Sometimes you can have really strong winds inland, so it would still be within the Green Bay Weather Service forecast area of responsibility. But they might know well that it's not going to be windy over the lake because it's going to be so stable over the water because it's cooler. So there could be a million different things that go. Of course, the obvious one is, too, that it could just be a blown forecast. We had a forecast in and around Dane County on Friday night, I think, for a severe weather possibility. And a few places got a shower, but most places didn't get too much. So those kind of things happen once in a while. But by and large, I'd say, when you get a 12 or 24-hour forecast nowadays, it's pretty much right on. But it does make you wonder, doesn't it? How can you get something so obviously incorrect? And those are usually the ones that we go back as scientists and try and figure out what was it that went wrong in the forecast? What did we not see?
Another time, they were predicting like 10 knot winds, and this was just about a week ago, and it was 20.
Yeah. No, the wind speed at the ground is so strongly controlled by the way in which the atmosphere is
stratified. Well, this was
stratified.
Out on the bay.
Oh, yeah, but still, at the surface level. Yeah. It's so strongly controlled by how the air is stratified, and that's something that's not always easy to pick out in these forecast models. As good as they are, that's the biggest problem they still have is stratification.
Well, thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. And a little time left. You can still join us with your question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890, 263-1890. Give us a call with your questions. Lightning can heat the air, what is it? How many thousand?
Five times the temperature of the sun.
It's like 30,000 Kelvin 50, or something.
Yeah. 50,000, yeah.
50,000 degrees?
Yep, it's hot.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's that heating that heats the air right around it that then generates sound waves.
That's what
the thunder is.
The air is expanding.
Yeah, the air then rapidly expands because, you know, when you heat something up, a gas in particular, it'll expand. Unless you've got it in a really strong pressure concealed.
Yeah, we don't have that.
We don't have that not in the atmosphere.
That's it right there. It's not pressure controlled.
It's not pressure controlled.
The rest of the environment is not being heated, so it's going to be banged into.
Yeah. Now, if you see lightning and then hear the thunder, there's a rule on that. How many seconds to figure out how many miles away it is?
Yeah, for each 5 seconds, it's a mile away. When you see it, you count five. 1,000, 2,000, and then for each five you get up to it, it's a mile away.
But if you see it...
And that's just the rule of thumb. So that's not, you know, I'm thinking there are cases where we talk about heat lightning. The thermal stratification of the atmosphere, again, can cause those sound waves to bend. And so sometimes you'll see it, and that sound wave will propagate right up above your head, and you won't hear it.
So, but if you're on a golf course, let's say, and you see lightning...
Don't count. Or at least count in the cart as you're driving back. And know how far you have to, how fast you have to drive.
Just because you see it a mile away doesn't mean there's not something percolating right over your head.
In fact, we have this thing called, lightning out of the blue. So you could see lightning in the distance and, wispy cirrus up above you. And you can get lightning bolts come out of the sides of these clouds or out of the tops of these clouds that come down to the ground and hit you. So if you see it, it's generally a good idea to seek shelter.
They take kids off the ball field when they see lightning. Sometimes that can be, especially in this part of the country where the ground is relatively flat, that can be miles away, dozens of miles away, and they just take kids off the field. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
Dugout.
Annie in Minocqua, hello to you.
Well, good morning. We're so glad to be able to ask you about the green flash. What can you tell us about the green flash? We've looked for it over Lake Superior forever.
I have finally seen one.
Really?
I saw it in Puerto Rico this summer. This February. I saw it in February.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yep. What it is that as the sun begins to set in the atmosphere, we generally get orange and yellow sunsets because all the blue light is scattered by the atmosphere, which means it's just redirected. And so by the time that light from the sun gets to our eyes, all the blue's gone. And the only things that's left are the oranges and the reds. But the close to the ground, we have a really strange, particularly over water, thermal structure. Like you may have temperature increase with distance from the ground as opposed to normally decreasing. And that happens over the water a lot. And what that thermal gradient does is it has the atmosphere acts like a lens, and it'll actually focus the green light from the top of the sun, and it'll just, instead of being scattered away, it'll be almost just like focused. And I've seen pictures of it, and whenever I see pictures of it, it's usually of Antarctica, so it's like an extreme situation, so the green spot is way up high. But in our, environment... I don't think it hangs up that high, and I think that's why a lot of us miss us. It actually occurs right at the very tip of the sun. And the only thing I can say is keep looking. Because when you see it, I was just watching it set. I was sitting there with Ann and a couple of other people, and we were watching it set. And, I just didn't think I'd see it. And all of a sudden it was like, what? Did you see that?
Yeah. How long did it last?
It only lasted about a second or two.
Yeah.
And again, because I don't think we see these extreme cases.
Yeah.
So just keep watching. You're going to see one. It's taken me about 15 years.
All right.
A lot of sunsets.
All right.
The underworld.
That's you, right.
Thanks for calling. Don and Warren, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi. I have the April of 04 National Geographic in front of me, and they have a two-page map of the U.S. showing where all the tornadoes, so F0 and 1, F2 and 3, and F4 and 5s are marked, and there are strange gaps in where this is from 1950 to 2003, and all of them are marked, and they're quite accurate because I've lived here for a long time, and one of the strange gaps is where I live, just over the line, and I'm looking at the map, and here's Wisconsin with streaks all over it, and just south, and from Dubuque, about two counties, and over toward Elgin, Chicago.
And nothing in Warren.
So now we know where Joshua and his wife need to move to.
It's good for property values.
Right,
Man, I wish we could go on. Don, I'm sorry, but we'll have to wait till the last Monday of next month. Steve, John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Thank you.
Been a real pleasure. Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW, our weather guys. And they'll be back next month, and we'll do this all over again. Tomorrow we talk White Coat Wisdom with Steve Buzalaki, former Wisconsin Public Radio medical reporter, and bankruptcy update from Ken Doran. Stay with us. Lots in store.